offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, who is joining you live from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center at Prashanthi Nilayam. It gives me great joy to meet you all again on this beautiful Thursday morning. And I do hope all of you are having a wonderful day and are keeping safe. I'm here to continue our program on the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the middle of the 10th chapter, what is referred to as the Vibhuti Yoga, a very beautiful chapter where Krishna speaks about aspects of the divinity that need to be contemplated upon, aspects of divinity that can be recognized in our everyday life around us. This whole chapter and a bit of the previous chapter that we went through gives us that on which the mind can be centered around. When we talk about dhyana, the process of meditation as a means to achieve the Lord, what must be meditated upon? What is that dhyaya, that which is worthy of being contemplated or meditated upon? Of course, the Lord has to be meditated upon, but the Lord is formless. The Lord cannot be comprehended by the mind. He is beyond the constructs of time and space, rupa and nama. Then how do we contemplate upon the Lord, right? That is the conundrum that is before the devotee who wants to contemplate on the Lord. And these vibhutis that the Lord speaks about fill in that gap. The Lord cannot be contemplated upon, but He must be contemplated upon. So you can use these qualities or these traits or these individuals, as we will see later in the chapter, they can be studied, contemplated upon, meditated upon, thought about, spoken about, and in the process, you will be moving closer to this goal, divinity, right? That's the importance of this particular chapter. A very beautiful, very profound chapter, and some of the things which Krishna is going to say today and in the following verses are very useful and practically applicable in that sense. So as always, we'll begin with a quick summary of what we covered last time. We covered 6 verses last time, pretty unusual. We usually cover not more than 2 or 3 verses. We covered 6 verses last time, verses 11 to 16. The reason being that most of those verses were the words of Arjuna, where he was summarizing what he had understood, and that's why we moved a bit quickly there. This portion of the Gita, which we covered last week, starts actually with the 10th shloka that we covered the week before that, when Krishna says that those who are devoted to Him and constantly engaged in His thoughts, to them He grants the Buddhi Yoga and enables them to reach Him. In the second line of the 11th chapter, the second line of the 11th verse that we covered last time, Krishna declares, Nashayam yam atma bhavastho jnana deepena bhavastva. Nashayam eva atma bhavastho jnana deepena bhasvata. Abiding in their mental activity as its object, I dispel the darkness born of ignorance by the brilliant lamp of knowledge. We discussed the idea behind the statement and the profound truth it conveys. The Lord is like the lamp. You can light the lamp and destroy the darkness. You cannot have a lamp in a place and have darkness along with it. When one contemplates incessantly on the Lord, He becomes the object that is installed in the mind. And Krishna says, He is the jnana deepa, the lamp of knowledge that once lit destroys darkness that is born of ignorance. And that is the meaning of that declaration. Nashayami, He says, I will destroy atma bhavastho, because I am installed in the mental activity of these people who are constantly contemplating upon me. Jnana deepena bhasvata, illumining that darkness or destroying the darkness by being the Jnana Deepa. We then discussed this analogy of the lamp and saw what Swami says about this. The oil of the lamp is devotion. The oil is called Sneha in Sanskritam, from the adjective Sneha, which means stickiness. So the same attachment is described as stickiness, interestingly, isn't it? The same attachment that one has to be diverted towards God. And this Sneha has to be contained and not be allowed to disperse. Just like how if you want to light a lamp, the oil cannot be spread over the floor. It has to be contained in something. And that is the physical lamp, right? So Swami says that lamp or that vessel is Vairagya. And the wick, Swami says, is Ekagrata, one-pointedness. You may have devotion, but unless that results in Ekagrata, single-pointed focus. Similarly, you might have the best oil, but that oil cannot be used to light a lamp if you do not have this wick, which allows that oil to be used as a fuel. So single-pointedness or Ekagrata is the wick. And the matchstick or the fire that lights the lamp is Paroksha Jnana or Tattva Jnana, the knowledge as explained by the scriptures or by the wise ones, right? So those four things which Swami says are important are oil of devotion, the vessel of Vairagya, the wick of Ekagrata, and the spark of Tattva Jnana that comes from the scriptures and the wise ones. But the interesting part of this shloka is what he says in the first line, which creates a sense of a paradox. He says, Eva anukampartham, meaning merely out of my compassion, I do this. Whatever he spoke about the lamp of wisdom, he says, Eva anukampartham, out of my compassion, I do all this. We discussed why this is a paradox, because we don't say that the lamp dispels darkness out of compassion. But the relevance of seeing God's compassion in this spontaneous act, just like when you light a lamp, the dispelling of darkness happens spontaneously. There is no willful, compassionate act from the side of the lamp. Similarly, God is Jnana, and once God is installed in the mind, the dispelling of Ajnana happens spontaneously. But nevertheless, we superimpose this idea of compassion on this act, because seeing this as an act of compassion helps us develop devotion, which, as we saw, is the oil or the fuel which is important in keeping this lamp burning. Then begins Arjuna's words from the 12th shloka. As I just mentioned, he more or less summarizes what he has understood, and then he builds towards asking a question. He says in that 12th shloka, Param Brahma, Supreme Brahman, the Supreme Being, Param Dhamma, the Supreme Abode, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan, you are the Supreme Purifier. Purusham Shashvatam, you are the Eternal Being. Divyam Adidevam, the Divine Source of all deities or devas. Ajam, unborn. Vibhum, the Omnipresent. These are all appellations for Lord Krishna. He says, Bhavan, I understand that you are all this. In the 13th, he says, this is not just my understanding, but that of all sages and great ones. And he names a few sages in the process. And in the 14th verse, Arjuna says, O Krishna, whatever you say, I consider as ritam. Ritam manye, he says, I consider whatever you have said as ritam. And this is very important acknowledgement of Arjuna. Ritam and satyam can be used synonymously, but when ritam is specifically used, it is to emphasize that this is not satyam, this is something that is more important or more greater than satyam. Because when you use ritam and satyam differently, satyam stands for that which I see as truth. I could be speaking something and I could believe that I'm speaking the truth, but what I'm doing is I'm being true to my experience. But ritam is that which is the absolute truth, which is not subjective, and which is the true experience of whoever who who interacts with that. So he says, whatever you have said, Krishna, I look upon it as ritam and not merely satyam. In the 15th, he says, O Supreme Person, the creator of all beings, the Lord of all beings, God of all gods, the Lord of the worlds, Swayameva Atmana Atmanam Vetha Tvam Purushottama. You yourself alone know yourself by yourself. A statement that reveals the deep understanding of Arjuna. When the Lord is installed in the mind, you do not understand the Lord, right? It is not that now I know the Supreme Being. When the Supreme Being is installed in the mind, the Supreme Lord installs himself with the knowledge of himself. And that is how you know him, right? That is how the self is revealed to you, because along with the self comes the knowledge of the self. And that's why he says, Swayameva Atmana Atmanam Vetatvam Purushottama. Only you alone know yourself. And the only way I will know you is when I install you in my mind and I become you, right? That is the essence of the Vedanta. Brahmavid Brahmaiva Bhavati. The Brahmavid can come only when Brahmaiva Bhavati happens. And that is the profound understanding that Arjuna reveals through this statement that he makes in the 15th verse. In the 16th verse, finally, Arjuna reveals his question. He says, Vaktum arhasi asheshana. Please tell me, without leaving out anything, Atma vibhutayaha, about your vibhutis, divyaha I, which are indeed divine. So this is the question that finally Arjuna places. He says, you have said so much, and whatever you have said, I've gathered all this, but please do tell me more. Vyaktum arhasi asheshana. And that's important. He says, tell me without leaving out anything, because we will come back to that question that Arjuna is asking and how it is not possible to satisfy him. So he says, Vaktum arhasi asheshana, without leaving out anything, Atma vibhutayaha. Tell me all about your vibhutis, divyaha hi, which are indeed divine. So that is the essence. Arjuna is asking Krishna to speak further about his vibhutis, and that was what he was coming to in all those shlokas that we covered last time. In the next two shlokas, he is going to articulate it even more, and he is again going to, in the process, reveal his understanding, and we will see what Arjuna conveys in that question. We will listen to the shloka in the voice of Brother Shyam, as we always do. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail what Arjuna is asking and why that is of significance.
Katham vidyamaham yogim Tvam sada parichintayan Keshu keshu cha bhaveshu Chintyosi Bhagavan Maya.
O yogi, how shall I know you by remaining ever engaged in meditation? And through what objects, O Lord, are you to be meditated upon by me? So that is the 17th verse of the 10th chapter. As we have seen many times earlier too, in Arjuna's question itself, there is always wisdom, right? He is not an ordinary person. We are in the week of the Guru Purnima. This Saturday we are celebrating and observing the Guru Purnima festival. Oftentimes, speaking during Guru Purnima, Swami would say that the most ideal Guru-Sishya pair is that of Arjuna and Krishna. And there's another name for Arjuna which will be used in Krishna's response, which we'll be covering today. And Swami would often quote that name and say that this is why Arjuna and Krishna are looked upon as an ideal Guru-Sishya pair. We'll come to that name later. And what Arjuna is asking here has been explained as such. He's just reiterating that by, in the process, saying that he has understood what Krishna is conveying. Arjuna refers to Krishna as yogin in this particular verse. Yogin means, O yogi. It is not to suggest that Arjuna is looking upon Krishna as another yogi. He recognizes him as Yogeshwara. That is why he is asking these questions to Krishna. And of course, in the second line of this verse itself, he addresses Krishna as Bhagavan. So yogi here does not mean one of the yogis or one yogi. Yogi here means he who is the goal of all yoga. So he says, Yogin, O yogi, Katham vidyam aham tvam, how shall I know thee? Sada parichintayan, by always meditating. Arjuna says, I understand that I can know you only by meditating upon you. But how should I meditate to know you or to recognize you? Katham vidyam aham tvam, how am I to know you? And if I want to know you, sada parichintayan, what kind of meditation should I do? Keshu keshu cha bhaveshu, and in what all aspects? Keshu keshu, in what all aspects? Chintayaha asi, are you to be thought of? Maya Bhagavan, by me, O Bhagwan. When we talk about these various aspects or qualities, which we refer to as vibhutis of the Lord, they stand out in creation. You know, they stand out in our life experience. Because they are recognizable, we can contemplate upon them. That is why Krishna names a host of qualities. In the beginning of the chapter, we saw that qualities such as forbearance, kindness, satya, these all stand out, right? Even though they are quite common and these are all human qualities, when we see them in individuals, they kind of stand out and they draw our attention to that individual or that person. Arjuna is asking about those qualities and maybe even individuals, as we will see later in the chapter, and entities that can be contemplated upon. And the purpose of that contemplation is so that, O Lord, I will know you better. The ultimate truth is everything is God, right? All beings, all natures, as Krishna had said in the beginning of, I think, the 7th chapter, he said, Sattva, Rajas, Tamas, everything comes from me. Good, bad, right, wrong, holy, unholy are all labels that you place on objects and things. Everything are sourced from me, right? In fact, Krishna himself said in a few verses ago that the vibhutis that you see are to be seen as being always united with me. That's why he said, vibhutim yoga. These are my vibhutis and you should recognize them as being ever united with me. But when we speak of chintana, thinking, that is a process that is done with the mind. And the nature of this mind is maya, right? The nature of the mind is maya. The tool that is being used for contemplation is this maya mind. And this idea that the vibhutis of the Lord are separate from him is also maya, right? So now when I see objects, I see them as what they are, right? When I see goodness in a person, I see her or him as a good person. Someone helps me, I thank the one who helped me and I go on. I thank that person. I'm grateful to that person. I have a talent. I am proud of the talent. I see a talent in somebody else. Maybe I'm jealous of that talent. Oh, I don't have that. And all this involves thinking, chintana. The idea of appreciating, the idea of ego, gratitude, all of these are different thoughts in the mind. So every observation has connected to it a chintana, a thinking process. Arjuna is asking here about parichintana, an evolved way of thinking or a more subtle way of thinking. This thinking is not related to what is just seen with the regular eye or the charma chakshu. You look for something beyond what meets the eye and contemplate upon it. So when I look at a good person, like when the qualities that we came across, when Krishna said ahimsa is a vibhuti, when you see a person who doesn't want to hurt others, instead of merely looking that as a good person, this is a person who is very soft-spoken or who doesn't harm others. Now you are training your mind to look at that quality of ahimsa and saying, oh, this quality is meant to remind me of the Lord. This quality is a vibhuti. So you are replacing the normal chintana, thinking process, with this parichintana. So Arjuna's question is, what are those qualities which when I observe should lead to this parichintana? Right? So for this, you first need discrimination. You first need to separate out things as good and bad, holy or unholy. And this is inevitable. Even though the underlying truth is everything is God. Right? And why we have to do this? Because the tool that we are using for this chintana is the mind, and the mind operates only through maya. And this maya itself, in its evolved form, is discrimination. When I am unwell, I go to a doctor, and let's say the doctor tells me, take this medicine, and he says, you follow a diet. He would say, let's say, you know, don't take oily food, or don't eat rice, or avoid fatty substances, or avoid carbohydrates. Swami would say in his discourses, for one to become well from a disease or from an ailment, two things are important: aushadam and patyam. Aushadam is medicine, patyam is dietary restrictions. Both of these are equally important, Swami would say. Similarly, for this ajnana or ignorance, if you consider that as a disease, for it to be removed, we need aushadam, which is the spiritual truth, the tattvajnana that we spoke about, the knowledge that comes from the scriptures or the wise ones. But you also need the patyam. Some things can be eaten, some things should be avoided. Similarly, some things should be thought about, some things should be ignored. When you eventually become healthy, going back to the example of a doctor and his dietary restrictions, when you become healthy, then you neither need aushadam nor do you need patyam. Meaning, you don't need paroksha jnana, you don't need the knowledge from others' experience, because now it has become aparoksha jnana. It has become your own experience. You don't need aushadam or the knowledge from others. And you don't have to follow dietary restrictions also, because now you have the knowledge that everything is divine. Now you are healthy enough to eat everything. So the purpose of aushadam is and patyam is to make aushadam and patyam irrelevant. Similarly, the purpose of paroksha jnana and discrimination is to make paroksha jnana and discrimination irrelevant in our spiritual life. So, for the mind to reach that state where it can contemplate on anything and still see God alone, this patyam, this dietary restriction of contemplating on only certain things, becomes important. That is what is being referred to here as parichintana. So Arjuna is defining that parichintana very succinctly. Tell me about that sada parichintana. Katham vidyam aham tvam, through which I shall know thee. And there are some thoughts, things, feelings on which contemplating is beneficial. Tell me about that. Keshu keshu cha bhaveshu chintayaha asi maya. Tell me about those things which when I can contemplate upon and I can think about you. That parichintayan, that which I can contemplate upon and be able to understand you better. We'll go to the next verse, the 18th verse. Arjuna continues this question. Let us see what he says in the next one.
vistareṇātmano yogam vibhūtiñca janārdana bhūyah kathaya triptirhi śrṇvato nāsti me mṛtam.
Speak to me again in full, O Krishna, about your attributes and glories, for I am not satisfied by hearing your ambrosial words. So that's the 18th verse of the 10th chapter. In this shloka, Arjuna acknowledges that what he is asking, Krishna has already explained. He is not asking for something new. He is acknowledging that, yes, you have already spoken about it, but I wish to hear more and in greater depth. He says, Vistarena, in detail, Bhuyaha Katham. Tell me again. Bhuyaha means again. Vistarena Bhuyaha Katham. In detail, tell me again. Atmanaha Yogam Vibhutim Chanyan Janardana. About your yoga and Vibhuti, O Janardana. He says, Yogam Vibhutim Cha. About your yoga and your vibhuti, about your glory and your glorious manifestation. Here, yoga refers to those aspects of divinity that are exclusive, right? When you talk about divine qualities, omnipresence, omnipotence, supreme selfless love, these are all qualities that are directly, you can attribute it to the Lord, right? So these can be referred to as the yogas of the Lord. I think a few chapters ago, Krishna said, all beings are contained in me and I am contained in all beings, and that is my yoga, right? Because that attribute you cannot apply to anybody else. That attribute can be applied only to the Lord. So those qualities that cannot be seen necessarily in other entities in creation are called yoga, and vibhuti are the manifestations that can be seen in the rest of creation. So he says, speak to me about yogam vibhutim cha, about yoga and your vibhuti. Arjuna refers to Krishna as Janardana, right? In this particular shloka, he refers to him as Janardana. The word Ardana or Ardana is derived from the root Arda, which has two meanings. One is to worship. So Janardana means one who is worshipped by all beings, all janas. Arda also means the act of going or making somebody go towards a certain direction, right? So Janardana is one who directs people. And when it is referred to Krishna, Janardana means one who directs people to their destiny or to their what they're rightfully earned through their actions and their behavior. And for whatever reason, Adi Shankara specifically mentions Janardana is one who sends the asuras to hell. Right? So I don't know why precisely that meaning is given. It might have some context in some Puranas and all that, I'm sure. But the meaning of Janardana is that. Either the one who is worshipped by all janas, or the one who directs people to the destiny that they've earned through their deeds. Why is Arjuna asking Krishna to speak more about his vibhutis and yogas? So that he explains. He says, he for triptaha shrunvataha na asti me. I am not yet satisfied with what has been said so far. Amritam, because it is so nectarine, it is so ambrosial. Meaning your words are so ambrosial and I am not satisfied with what I have received thus far. When we want someone to repeat, there can be two reasons. One reason is we did not grasp what was said. We did not understand what was conveyed. The other is, I'm not yet satisfied, right? It is so beautiful that I would like to listen to it more and more in detail, right? somebody comes and tells you about their problems, you're not going to tell me more about it. No, if someone has come back from a vacation and they're saying that, oh, we had a wonderful time and we went to this place, you would say, oh, tell me more. I'm not satisfied listening to it, right? Or when you're sitting in a classroom and your teacher is telling you a concept and you've not understood it, you ask the teacher to explain more in detail or in some other way or using some other analogy, right? One, we do not understand. The other, we are not satisfied. In the beginning of the third chapter, Arjuna asked Krishna to repeat the difference between Sankhya and Karma Yoga. At that time, he said, Vyamishrena iva vakyena buddhim mohayasi iva me. You confuse my mind with statements that seem to contradict each other. Right? So the repetition that he was asking there, he said, so please explain to me. He said, because you're confusing, your words are confusing me. When words are spoken in trying to explain a concept, as we have discussed this before, those words are supposed to create the same connections in our mind. The listener's mind should understand the words in such a way that the concept is recreated in the mind. I have read something about the Gita. I have done some study. And now through my words, I am trying to recreate that same understanding of the concept in your mind. If that desired effect doesn't happen, then you will have to tell that you have to repeat yourself or you have to explain it in a different way. And that's what Arjuna did in the beginning of the third chapter. But here Arjuna is asking for repetition for the second reason. He says, because I am thrilled with what you're telling me, Krishna, and I'm not satisfied with the amount of ambrosial words that you've spoken so far. So please speak more. So that is where Arjuna's question ends. And after all the summary of what he has understood, he places before Krishna his prayer. He says, I'm not satisfied. Please speak more. So from the next verse, Krishna's response begins. Right, so we'll listen to the 19th verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss what Krishna is saying in that.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Hantate Kathayishyami Divyahyatma Vibhutayah Pradhanyatah Kuru Shrestha Nastyanto Vistarasyami.
The Lord said, indeed I shall tell you, O Arjuna, my auspicious manifestations or vibhutis, those that are prominent among these, there is no end to their extent. That's the 19th verse of the 10th chapter. And Krishna is pleased with this question that Arjuna is asking. Hanta. Hanta is an expression of delight. It's almost like saying very well or well, right? In English, the way you say that when you're, it's a word that is an expression of one's delight at hearing what the other person said. So he says, Hanta te katayishyami. Oh, well, indeed, I will tell you or describe to you. Atma vibhutayah, my vibhutis divyaha hi, that are indeed divine. But the question is where to begin and where to stop. The Lord's vibhutis are unending. It can never be spoken of entirely, right? That because Arjuna's question was, what should I meditate upon to know you? Krishna doesn't necessarily have to tell him everything, right? Arjuna doesn't have to know and contemplate on everything. The syllabus might be vast, but Arjuna is asking, oh Krishna, what should I study to pass this exam of samsara? It is almost like that. So Krishna says, Kuru Shrestha, O best of Kurus, Katayishyami Pradhanyatah. I will tell you about the prominent among them. Krishna is saying, I will tell you the important topics from the syllabus. Na asti antaha, there is no end, vistarasya, of the details may of me. If you recall, Arjuna said, Vaktum asheshana, tell me entirely. But Krishna is saying the details are endless. It is impossible to tell entirely about it. But I will tell you about what is important, right? The important aspects of the syllabus, I will tell you. You know, when you have a good teacher, the good teacher will never leak a question paper, right? That would be unethical. But if your teacher is the one who is also going to set the examination paper, in the process of teaching itself, he or she will, you know, very subtly lay emphasis on the topics that you know are likely to come in the question paper, isn't it? That is the advantage of having the one who sets the question paper as your teacher. If I were to merely read a textbook and say I'm a very studious person and I'm sincere enough, that is enough for me to clear the exam. I can have the scriptures with me, I can read them with Shraddha, and that is enough for me to probably cross this ocean of samsara, clear this exam. If I added to that also have a teacher who can explain and encourage, and the process becomes even better, even easier, right? That's the role of a guru. The guru is one who is able to encourage and push you along this journey. And if you get stuck reading these scriptures, and if it leads to misunderstandings, the guru is there to clarify. The difference between reading the scriptures and reading scriptures and having the guru is this advantage. Now, if you have the Lord Himself as the guru, it is like having a teacher. You have the scriptures, you have a teacher, but the teacher is also the one who is going to set the paper and also going to evaluate it. That is the advantage we all have when we say Swami is our guru, right? And this is the week of Guru Purnima, where we express our gratitude for this very, very profound blessing that Swami has given us. So that is the advantage that Arjuna is also having here. So Krishna is telling, you want me to tell entirely about my vibhutis? That is never possible at all. But I will tell you about those vibhutis. The second half of your question is, what should I contemplate upon to know you better? So I will tell you about those things, those few things. If you contemplate upon, you will understand me better. I will speak to you about those important aspects. So saying, Krishna speaks of the first and the most important vibhuti. This again is the next shloka that we're going to go through. Shloka number 20 is considered a very important shloka in the Gita. And how do we say a shloka is important? That shloka must have been quoted by Swami in his discourses, and the next shloka is one such shloka where Swami has spoken about it many times in his discourses. We will listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail about this important shloka.
Ahamatma gudakesha sarvabhutashayasthitaha ahamadishcha madhyancha bhutanamanta evacha.
O Gudakesha, I am the Self residing in the hearts of all beings, and I am the beginning and the middle, as also the end of all beings. So that is the 20th verse of the 10th chapter, a very beautiful and profound verse, a verse that captures the essence of Vedanta. Of course, there are many like this throughout the Gita. We have come across many. But as I said, we give more importance to those verses that Swami has quoted in his discourses. And this is one such verse. First, we'll speak about the name that Krishna uses for Arjuna, which I made a reference to in the beginning of the episode today, when I said that Swami says Krishna and Arjuna are the ideal Guru-Sishya pair, and Swami uses one particular appellation for Arjuna and another for Krishna to highlight this. Krishna calls Arjuna Gudakesha. And if you recall, we have come across this name much, much earlier. At the time when Sanjaya was referring to Arjuna and Krishna, he was saying Gudakesha and Rishikesha. So you could say that Gudakesha is a name that Arjuna already was popular by, right? It is not merely Krishna referring to him as Gudakesha, even a third person like Sanjaya was referring to him as Gudakesha. I will quickly repeat what we had discussed about the name Gudakesha at that point in time. Arjuna has this name because he was known as a person who had overcome his sleep. Gudaka means sleep or sloth. So Gudaka Isha means the master, the one who has mastered sleep. And this again goes into the stories of Mahabharata, where one of the sadhanas that Arjuna does is he is able to completely overcome sleep. But Swami says that in general, the name represents an aspirant, a spiritual aspirant, who has conquered sleep or conquered the senses. And Krishna is referred to as Rishikesha. And Swami explains the significance of these two words, Gudakesha and Rishikesha. And one of these quotes, there are many places Swami has spoken about it. I've just picked one of the quotes as a reference. Swami says, and I quote, Krishna, who is Rishikesha, addressed Arjuna as Gudakesha. Rishikesha is the Lord, the master of all senses. Arjuna is Gudakesha, the one who has acquired sense control. Gudakesha is the disciple of Rishikesha. The Lord of the senses is the supreme guru, and the one who has acquired control of the senses is the ideal Sishya. This is from chapter 18 of the Samukos 1979 series. This is what I refer to in the beginning of the episode 2. Swami says, this is why Krishna and Arjuna are an ideal guru-sishya pair. The guru must be one who has conquered the senses, and the aspirant must be one who aspires to conquer the senses, so who is prepared for this. So the ultimate expression of the guru is Rishikesha, the one who is the lord of the senses, and the ultimate expression of the sishya who is aspiring to do this is Gudakesha, the one who has conquered the senses through effort. Now coming back to the rest of the shloka. Krishna said, I cannot tell you completely about my vibhutis, it is not possible, but I will tell you of the prominent ones. Katayishyami pradhanyatah. The first point Krishna speaks about, the first vibhuti that he speaks about, is our own self, the Atma. Why go about looking for me elsewhere? I am right here within you. That is what Krishna declares in this particular shloka. Aham Atma Gudakesha Sarvabhutashayastitaha. Aham Atma, I am the Atma, Sarvabhuta, not only in you but in all beings. Ashayastitaha. I am seated in every being as the Atma. Aham Atma Gudakesha Sarvabhutashayastitaha. Every being is made up of the gross body, the subtle mind, and the Atma, which is even subtler. In truth, all of this is divine, right? Because there is nothing which is not divine. Since everything has the same divine source, there can be nothing which is not from the divine, so nothing can be considered as not being divine. That is the fundamental truth. But if we have to see as vibhutis that we can contemplate upon in this apparatus called the individual, the Atma is the vibhuti that can be contemplated upon. Recognize me as being seated in you as the Atma. Recognize me as being seated in every being as the Atma. And then he goes on to say, Aham Adihi cha and I am the beginning, madhyam cha and the middle, bhutanam antah eva cha, and also the final end of all beings. So he says, I am the self seated in all beings, and he says, aham adihi cha, I am the beginning, I am also the middle, I am also the culmination or end of all beings. In my view, this statement can be, in one way of looking at it, is simply as saying divinity being the source, the final destination of all beings and sustenance, that is the concept of Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara. That's one of the direct ways of looking at this statement. But when we look at it from the point of the question that Arjuna asked, and Krishna promised that I will describe, I will give you those aspects that you can contemplate upon. This statement has to be seen from that point of view. When you look at the birth of a being, when you just consider this concept of a new life being born, that act has to be recognized as a miracle. When you see life itself as a miracle, that is the madhyamcha aspect. And even death must be recognized as a miracle. Bhutanam antah eva cha. Imagine this, even with all our scientific advancement, we still can't create life. We can create suitable environment for life to grow in, like we do in the case of tissue culture, or like some scientists are now trying to recreate that primordial soup, as they call it, in which inorganic material eventually became organic substance and that eventually led to life. They're able to recreate that entire setup. They're even able to create RNA molecules that are able to perpetuate themselves, but yet we can't create life. Imagine, with all our advances, this is a science that is still beyond our reach. But yet, even the most uneducated person is able to create life through the natural process of procreation. Why a person, even animals, birds, and those of very, very low intelligence like worms and insects, are able to create life? Something that is beyond the reach of science, but is yet within the reach of the lowest intelligent life forms. Isn't that a miracle in itself? Why shouldn't birth of a being itself be looked upon as a vibhuti of the Lord and contemplated? I feel that is why Krishna is saying, aham adihi bhutanam. Then he says, madhyam cha, I am the middle. Meaning between life and death, when life is sustained, even that is a miracle. It's an incredible miracle. If you were to ask me, what is the best time to think of God with gratitude? I will tell you, it is when you're answering nature's call in the morning. We do it every day. We consider it one of the insignificant parts of our life, not something we really speak about in public. In fact, some of you may be wondering, what is this fellow talking about defecating and urinating on Radio Sai? But think of it. That one seemingly simple act that we perform every day means that we take in through the mouth something and it comes out going through the system of the body, which means all the processes in the body are functioning well. Isn't that a miracle? Any of those functions, if they are not fine, be it the liver, the pancreas, the gallbladder, and all of that, any of these various systems or various organs which are involved in this, me putting something in one hole and letting it out through another hole, it seems like a very simple natural process. But for this input and output to happen, all of these organs have to function properly. And for me to benefit out of this act, all of these systems inside have to be functioning properly, and it is functioning. If you're able to sit and you're able to listen and make sense of what I'm speaking, it means that all of these things are functioning properly. Right? And any of those functions, if they are not fine, to treat that or have that same process performed outside the body, it is so very complex. I always say this, and I'm sure I must have mentioned this earlier in this series too. As a student of chemistry, I know how complex it is to perform a single organic reaction in a lab. How many parameters we have to take care of, and how much skill is involved in just doing one reaction from start to finish. And even after a master's degree in that subject, I still cannot claim that I'm good at it. But in each of our body, millions of such reactions are happening right now to sustain your life. And you don't even need a degree in chemistry to do those reactions in your body. Isn't that a vibhuti of the Lord worthy of being contemplated upon? That is why when answering nature's call, remember Swami and say, Swami, everything in my body is functioning so well. I am grateful to you. You have given me such good health, and I'm able to digest the food I eat. I'm able to absorb the water that I drink. I'm able to breathe. The pandemic that is raging around us has suddenly taught us the value of simple oxygen, isn't it? The simple act of breathing we suddenly look at it and say, oh my God, we've been doing this all these years and we have forgotten to recognize it as a vibhuti. And then he says, bhutanam antah evacha, I am also the end. Even death is a beautiful miracle. That's why Krishna, when he was listing out the vibhutis in the start of this chapter, he says, bhavaha, abhavaha, birth as well as death is a vibhuti. Just as birth of life is beautiful, so is death. Though when we speak about death, we consider it so ominous. But if you really look at it, what does death stand for? What does it represent? I call this body me. After death, what happens to this body? What happens to this quote-unquote me? It silently becomes one with the rest of the nature. It becomes rest of the elements. Just so seamlessly. And it is the same whether you are a 300 pounds bodybuilder or a person whose body is wasted by disease. It doesn't matter. When you die, this process is set forth. You may be the president of the most powerful country, or you might be a beggar on the street. Death treats you the same way. That equanimity, that equality, isn't that a quality of the divine? Isn't that a quality that when we contemplate upon, we can think more of God? So the way life is formed is a miracle. The way we are able to constantly convert substances outside me into my body, it's a miracle. I eat an apple, I eat salt, I eat some grains. And through this amazing process, all of that substance becomes me. It becomes a part of me. It adds to this body. It enables me to think. It enables me to be this personality. That's an incredible miracle. And this body that has been made with the minerals and nutrients from outside silently fades away back into this canvas of nature after this process called death. What an incredible miracle. So when Arjuna asks Krishna, tell me about those vibhutis on which, if I meditate, I will be able to understand you better. For a devotee, this concept of understanding God and loving God is not different, right? Though we don't try to understand Swami in our relationship, but we are in a way trying to wrap our minds around Swami. What is he like? What is he doesn't like? How would Swami want me to react in this situation? How would Swami want me to lead my life? All of this is nothing but the process of trying to understand him. So when Krishna say, when Arjuna says, I want to understand you, it means I want to go closer to you. Right? From Samipyam to Sarupyam. When you try to go closer to the Lord, you set off this process of Salokyam, Samipyam, Sarupyam. And when there is no distinction whatsoever, it is Sayujyam. So he says, I want to understand you better, O Lord. And what should I contemplate upon? And Krishna says, start with your own self. And the self in all. Aham Atma Gudakesha Sarva Bhutha Shayastitaha. I am the Atma in you and in every being that you encounter. O Arjuna, meditate upon this. Right? That chintana, parichintana that we spoke about. Today I see a person, I see a person. I see so-and-so. I refer to that person by a name. I call him or her by the designation they hold or in relation to my current status in life. But that parichintana which Krishna is suggesting is when you look at a being, can you say that there is the Atma situated in that person and that Atma is my Lord? It's not easy. That is why it needs contemplation. If it comes spontaneously, then you don't need parichintana at all. So he says, Aham Atma Gudakesha Sarva Bhutashayastita. Then he says, Aham Adihi Cha Madhyam Cha Bhutanam Antahevacha. I am the source, the sustenance and dissolution of all beings. Meaning, the coming to existence of beings is my vibhuti. How are they able to live as a form? That is my miracle. And how they pass away into the stream of time in the name of death is also my vibhuti. Contemplation on any of these or all of these will bring you close to me. While these two shlokas are about the individual, right, or related to experience of one's own living, one's own life, digestion, as I said, or living and dying, the next set of shlokas are about different classes of beings or objects or ideas, right, where Krishna is going to say, in this group of entities, I am this. A very popular section of the Gita, right? Often quoted by Swami too. I think we will start that portion next week so that we don't mix with this. But this is a very, very profound verse. And I think it is a beautiful shloka to conclude with running up to the Guru Purnima celebrations, right? The Guru is supposed to teach you that process of meditation or the process of sadhana through which you can move closer to that goal, right? As Swami tells in one of the discourses, the true guru is one who is ready to raise the sishya to his own level, right? That is the greatness of the guru. The guru is so selfless that very aspect which makes the guru superior to the sishya, he is ready to sacrifice. When the guru gives this jnana, this ability to know your true self, he is removing this distinction that separates him from you. And as we celebrate this Guru Purnima festival, as we acknowledge this greatest good fortune that we have of having the same person, the source of the subject, as the teacher of our subject, as the examiner who is going to look at us and say how well we are fed, we have this unique good fortune of having that Gitacharya, that source of all wisdom, as our guru, not merely as our guru, but as our mother, as our father, as our guide. There's nothing more. There is no greater blessing that he can give you, isn't it? So acknowledging this great blessing that he has given us as we move towards this Guru Purnima festival, let us contemplate upon this beautiful verse, which is the essence of all Vedanta. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll continue this Gita pilgrimage with all of you, with the company of all of you next week. Again, the afternoon satsang that we're going to be playing is going to be a rebroadcast, so I'm not going to come back after Bishu's segment. I'll meet you all next week. In a short while from now, Bishu will come take over for the Outside Inside Deep Inside segment. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.